This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents Nothing to Lose by Victoria Selman, performed by Karin Kass. The most dangerous creation of any society is the man who has nothing to lose. James A. Baldwin. He killed those girls. I have to tell someone, or I'm next. Saturday. Chapter 1. Interview Room 3, Scotland Yard, 12:02.
My God, how can this be happening? The man thinks, brain spinning out, as the detectives bring him in for interrogation.
The male DS is wearing a waistcoat and pocket square. His face is young, but his eyes are hard, not like the female. She looks softer.
Good cop, bad cop, he thinks. But both are out to get me.
Have a seat, the female says, gesturing with her hand. The man sits down, eyes skittering round the room. There's a white video camera mounted on the wall, a table set with three chairs, all bolted to the floor. A large black recorder tucked into a recess in the wall. And no window. A low hum's coming from the overhead fluorescent lighting, as though an insect's trapped inside the dirty bulb. And there's a lingering smell of cigarettes, despite the big no-smoking sign on the door. The room's a grey box, a holding pen, a torture chamber for the claustrophobic. The man's mouth is dry. It tastes stale. His tongue's sticking to the inside of his cheeks. It's cold in here, but he's sweating like mad. His armpits are damp, his shirt's glued to his back. There's no way the detectives won't have noticed and drawn a conclusion, he thinks. First impressions count, he knows that. He's made his living out of it. The male unwraps a cassette tape and puts it in the recorder. He clicks a button and the wheels begin to whir.
I must inform you this interview is being audio recorded and may be used in evidence if your case is brought to court,
he says, shuffling his notes on top of a pile of case files as he goes through the spiel.
My name is D.S. Silk. For the benefit of the tape, could you please state your full name and date of birth?
The man's voice cracks in his throat as he answers. He's not used to sitting on this side of the table. He realizes his nerves will be another strike against him. Language is easy to manipulate. He's always been good at reading people and pushing his agenda, but controlling his body is different. Emotions ooze out of our skin. Even dogs can understand us, he thinks, remembering an incident not so long ago. D.S. Silk is non-confrontational to start with, blatantly trying to lull him into a false sense of security.
Letting me dig a pit for myself, he thinks, waiting to shove me in.
The detective rolls up his sleeves and leans forward, fists on the table. The female is watching the man closely. They're coming now, the questions he can't answer.
Where is she? What have you done with her?
3 days earlier, Wednesday. Chapter 2. Bloomfield Villas, London, 0300.
Help! Please! Someone!
My voice came out as a whisper, croaky and weak, though in my head I was screaming. I was short of breath, dizzy and exhausted. My blood pressure was dropping, my pulse thready. I started to shake. My skin felt cold and clammy. I was lightheaded and nauseous. My body was going into shock, flooding with epinephrine, a reaction to the blood loss. Without an IV, I'd die. If I hadn't been tied up, I could have put pressure on my stab wounds to stem the bleeding. I could have loosened my clothes and elevated my legs. I could have called an ambulance too, I thought, looking over at my mobile phone, lying inches out of reach in a spreading pool of blood. Snap to, Mackenzie. I inhaled deeply from my diaphragm to steady my breathing. Preserve your strength. That's what they taught us. Don't waste energy on things you can't control. And yet my mind was a kill house, thoughts ricocheting off the walls, firing off in every direction. Multiple sharp force injuries to the upper torso, cuts to the breasts and legs, extreme overkill. This homicide was personal. How many crime scenes have I attended? How many killers have I profiled based on their handiwork? Except I was the victim now. Someone else would be examining my body and looking for clues. Would they understand what had happened here? Would they see what I would have seen? As the dull, throbbing pain in my ribs became dagger sharp, the front door to our apartment block opened and Duncan came out into the street holding a steaming bowl of pasta. I could smell the homemade tomato sauce and freshly grated parmesan from the pavement. It made me want to puke. I knew what was coming next. I watched my husband twirl the spaghetti round his fork and bring it to his lips. My heart squeezed. The panic rose as bile in my esophagus. In the distance there was a buzzing noise, loud and insistent. I tried to shout, to warn him what was about to happen, but my voice was locked in my throat. He must have sensed me, though, because at that moment, he looked right where I was lying. My body bound, my flesh punctured with open-mouthed lesions. And yet he didn't react. Why isn't he moving out of the way? Duncan, get down! Nothing. Despite all my training and years of experience, there wasn't a single damn thing I could do to save him. The bullet came then, the bullet I knew would come, the bullet I couldn't stop, fired from an unmarked VW Crafter with no plates. An execution shot which blasted my husband's forehead, leaving a deep circular wound with seared edges and heavy tattooing. His knees buckled, his body tilted forward, and he collapsed onto the concrete, the poppy in his buttonhole sprayed with arterial blood. I screamed again, and this time the sound came out so loudly it woke me up. My heart was clobbering, the sheets soaked in sweat, my husband's spot cold as a grave. My mobile was vibrating on the nightstand next to the device I'd found only hours earlier. Backlit on the screen were three words. Scotland Yard Homicide. Chapter 3. I fumbled for the switch on my bedside lamp and answered the phone in a sleep-furred voice. Since quitting the Special Forces and going freelance, there have been plenty of late-night briefings, critical updates and pre-dawn crime scene visits. But a Zero Dark 30 call from Scotland Yard when I wasn't part of an investigation, that was new. Whatever this was about, it wasn't going to be a beach barbecue, that's for sure. Zeba Mackenzie. I reached for a biro and pad of paper, my brain already shifting into first.
Mac, DCI Falcon here. Apologies for the ungodly hour, but we need your help. We have...
He hesitated.
A situation.
He was rattled. This was serious then. Falcon's been on the job since Jesus was a corporal. Like me, he's seen more than his fair share of guts and gore, and also like me, he's become habituated to the sort of violence that would send Joe Public into a lifetime of therapy. So what could have shaken him now?
What's going on, sir?
The homicide in Primrose Hill, you know the one?
Aye, of course. The papers had been full of it. No surprises there. That level of violence, never mind depravity, always shifts copies. On top of which, the victim was a pretty young mother. The police still had no leads, and the discovery site was slap-bang in the middle of Celebrity Central, home to the sort of A-listers even I've heard of. It was Christmas and Hanukkah rolled into one for the newsboys. They'd be pumping the story until there was no juice left. I always take a professional interest in murder cases, even when I'm not on the investigation team. But this one was different. This time, the victim looked a lot like me. Yasmin Pejman. Nasty business, I said to Falcon now.
Yep.
And there it was again, another pause. My stomach tripped. So much of communication is non-verbal. I didn't need him to say what he did next. It wasn't just his speech patterns that gave it away. I've been doing this long enough to know the way killers work, and the way Yasmin Pejman's body had been posed hinted at what was to come. I'd almost been waiting for it.
The perp struck again, he said. Same MO, same victimology, found in the same area as the last dump site.
And the positioning of the corpse?
Like before, legs splayed, skirt up, womb ripped out.
So the signature was the same too. Contrary to what most law enforcement bods will tell you, signature, not MO, is the critical component when it comes to profiling offenders and linking crimes. It's the combination of ritual and method, and is as unique as a set of fingerprints. Understand the signature, and you understand the perp.
Two murders in 1 week. You know what that means.
We're dealing with a serial killer, and he's just warming up. Chapter 4.
We're taking over from Major Crimes at Kentish Town. I'm putting a team together and I want you on it,
said Falcon, as I processed the implications of a serial killer loose in the capital. He'd struck twice in a week. That wasn't much of a cooling-off period. From experience, the length of time between kills would only shorten as the offender got into his stride. The Scotland Yard MIT would have its work cut out. By my reckoning, it had a matter of days to stop the offender before he struck again, and on top of that, it needed to hammer down the hysteria that was bound to erupt the moment news of a second attack got out. Serial murderers always make the headlines. It's the rubbernecker phenomenon. Evil fascinates us. But when it's on our doorstep, all that changes. If I joined the investigation, I'd be analysing the killer's psyche and anticipating his next move. I'd be zipping myself up in his skin, looking out through his peepholes, seeing the world the way he does. But it was a big if. I'm a match for most killers. I've dedicated my life to understanding them, both in the desert and back on the block. And I've consulted on serial homicides both here and abroad. There's even a book with my name on the jacket, but was now the right time to be getting involved in an investigation of this sort, given what I'd just found? My eyes flicked again to my nightstand, and then over to the empty spot where my husband should have been. The place that's been cold and untouched for almost 2 years now. I still can't bring myself to lie there. Doing so would mean accepting he's gone. Duncan. A part of me is jealous of him. He was killed instantly by a single bullet as we walked out of our local Italian. My death has been slower. There's been no way back into the light for me. I'm learning to live with the pain, but sometimes it gets too much. Sometimes it saws me off at the knees. When I start spiraling inwards, incarcerated inside my own head, unable to trust my thoughts, I'm totally FUBAR. Fucked up beyond all recognition. Since Duncan died, finding his killer has been as hopeless as my nightmares. Until yesterday. A moth flew into my living room as I was lying on the sofa, staring up at the ceiling, wishing I could get my hands on a time-turner. It was fluttering about, bumping into things, looking for a way to escape. As I tried to guide it towards the open window, I noticed something off about the wall around one of the plug sockets. The paint was a shade darker than everywhere else, and there was a small chip in the plaster. I'd painted the walls myself when I first moved in, years before I met Duncan. Dulux Wild Primrose. I hadn't repainted since, so why was this patch different to the rest? I managed to get the moth to the window and out into the night air, then I fetched my black maglite from the hall cupboard. Curious, I shone it round the edges of the plug socket. Along with the discoloration and chipping, there were scratch marks on the plastic facing, and the screws holding it in place were a fraction larger than in the other sockets. I chewed my lip as an idea began to form. I disconnected the lamp on the table by the sofa and plugged it in. But when I flicked the switch, nothing happened. The socket was a fake. My first thoughts inevitably leapt to recording devices and microphones, a hangover from my old job. But once I'd unscrewed the plate, I realized I'd been wide of the mark. The plug socket wasn't concealing a bug. It was hiding a safe. Chapter 5.
So, what do you say?
Said Falcon.
We could really use your help on this one.
I thought of what I'd found in the safe, the date it had been saved, the information on it, the trouble Duncan had taken to hide it. It had to be linked to what had happened that night. Finally, a lead after all this time. And then I thought of what Falcon was asking and how full on the work would be. If I joined the murder team, how would I find the time to investigate what I'd discovered? True, Duncan's homicide was a cold case, but didn't I owe it to him to make it my priority? Didn't I owe it to myself? Yesterday's newspapers were strewn on the floor by my bed, 5 of them, because I never trust one person to give me the score. The broadsheet headlines were relatively restrained. Hunt still on for Primrose Hill killer. No leads in murder case. The same couldn't be said for the tabloids, though. Murder in Celebville. Monster on the loose. Bring my mummy back. Yasmin Pejman's face stared out from each cover. A striking woman with big brown eyes and long dark hair. Next to her, a little boy whose mother would never kiss him goodnight again. I had to get to the bottom of Duncan's homicide. The black dog would stalk me forever if I didn't. Only the truth could set me free. But if the Primrose Hill killer wasn't caught soon, more women would die, more families would be destroyed. Whenever I interview victims' relatives, I always tell them I know what they're going through. It sounds cliched, but I'm not fobbing them off with platitudes. I know what it feels like to wake up in the morning and curse the fact you didn't die in your sleep. I know what it's like to live a half-life, seeing the world in shades of what might have been. And I know what it's like to lose the person you love. So, knowing what I know, feeling what I feel, how could I stand back and let someone else go through the same thing? Screwed if I do, screwed if I don't, I thought as I said to Falcon, count me in.
You had me worried there for a minute,
he said, his words coming out in a rush as if he'd been holding his breath.
I've made Donald Isakson SIO, do you know him?
It wasn't a strange question. I've worked on plenty of cases for Falcon, but rarely twice with the same senior investigating officer. Scotland Yard's a big place, and I'm always on the move. I learned early on not to get too close to a team. Same as in the SF. You never know who you're going to be fighting alongside next. No, I haven't met him. What's he like?
Well, you won't find him nicking pints down the Lamb and Flag, but he's a sound DI.
So, reading between the lines, a miserable sod, but good at his job. Send me the crime scene location and I'll meet him there.
Great, and Mac, thanks. It's good to know you're on board.
Glad to be of service. I pushed back the covers and swung my legs out of bed. Christ, it's cold enough for snivel gear in here, I thought, shivering as I pulled on black trousers and a turtleneck. I rubbed my hands together and hurried through to the kitchen to fix some lifer juice for the road. My breath came out in dragon puffs. The flat could have been a morgue, it was so damn icy. I was just firing up the espresso machine when my mobile pinged again. Falcon, I thought, pulling it out of my pocket. Only it wasn't the DCI. It was Jack Wolfe, Duncan's best friend. Does that guy never sleep? I clicked the SMS link.
Fear has two meanings. Fuck everything and run, or face everything and rise.
It was corny as shit, except Jack wasn't being flippant. He was referring to what we'd talked about last night, and to the flash drive Duncan had taken such lengths to hide just 2 days before the bullet that had so efficiently dispatched him. As I hurried out the flat, I texted him back. I'm awake. Call me. Chapter 6.
My God, it's happened again. I'm stuck in that Salvador Dali painting. The tree trunk is my neck and my head's an exploding volcano. Please help me. I feel like I'm losing my mind. I'm home, having a glass or two. My husband is out again, and I'm all by myself, feeling this sadness so heavy I can't breathe right. I'm drinking too much. I know I am. But I can't stop, and I don't even care. The next thing I know, it's hours later. The house is dark, perilline black, and I'm lying, wet and naked on my bed, no idea how I got there, shivering with this strong feeling something's very wrong. I hear my husband stomping about downstairs. He sounds angry. I can hear him cussing and throwing stuff around. There's the noise of glass smashing, and a loud thud. I start shaking, but it's not because I'm cold. He starts coming up the stairs, and my heart's beating hard, even though I don't know why. My arms are sore, like they're scratched. But I've no idea how they got that way. I have no memory of anything. Part of my brain may as well have been cut out. What did I fucking tell you? My husband says, storming into the bedroom. A fleck of spit lands on my face. I shrink into myself. I never thought he'd be someone who'd swear at me. In the beginning, he was so sweet and gentle. Not anymore, though. Not since. Were you even listening? He says, his voice blade sharp. I don't know what he's talking about. I can't remember anything. It's like the time between him being gone and him coming back has been wiped out. But my body must remember something. Because when he comes over to the bed, his voice suddenly all soft. My arms fly up to protect my head. I flinch as he covers me with the duvet. His hands are like an icebox. They're so cold. The light's on now. I see there's dirt on his trousers. And a stain on his shirt sleeve that looks a lot like blood.
Chapter 7. Bloomfield Villas, London, 0417. My mobile rang just as I was getting into my Porsche, a silver 1988 911 turbo with a tan leather interior, four-spoke sport wheels, and convertible top. I always say I don't need kids. This here is my baby. Morning, Wolfie. I crooked the phone between my shoulder and ear and tapped the postcode Falcon had sent into my phone's sat-nav as the Bluetooth kicked in.
So you couldn't sleep either, huh? I still can't get my head round it.
You and me both. I slid the car into gear and pulled away from the curb, glad not to have to say what I was really doing up and about at oh silly hundred hours. As a crime reporter with a major national, Jack would find out soon enough about the Primrose Hill killer turning serial, but I'd be breaking all manner of regs if I said anything before the Yard had a chance to get in front of the story. It's not just what was on the flash drive, I said. It's also the trouble he took to hide it. Says a lot.
How do you mean?
Well, the Yard's not exactly an open house. Why not keep the stick there if it was so damn precious?
True.
The only reason I can come up with is he was hiding it from someone who works there, I said, accelerating onto Maida Avenue.
Why would he need to keep things from his colleagues?
Maybe he didn't trust them, or thought he'd get smoked if anyone found out what he was doing.
So you're saying he was flying solo?
I smiled. If Jack can bring aviation into something, he will. If he's not cruising the big blue yonder in his Grumman Tiger, he's thinking about it. Captain Airedale, I call him when it gets too much. Whatever he was investigating, it wasn't official, that's for sure. Why else hide it at home? I said.
But why hide it from you? I mean, going to all the bother of drilling a safe and covering it up with a fake plug socket and everything. It's pretty extreme, don't you think?
I sucked my bottom lip. He was right. Why hadn't Duncan talked to me? Why hadn't he told me what was going on? What I'd found on the flash drive showed something had been eating at him. I thought back to our last days together. He'd been distracted. He wasn't sleeping, and he'd been gnawing the inside of his cheek. Another sign he was worried. "What's up, Dunk? You don't seem yourself," I'd said, curling up on the sofa next to him with a glass of Chianti, ready to do the Times crossword together. A bit middle-aged, middle class, but our thing.
"Just some stuff going on at work," he'd said as he put on his black reading glasses.
I'd watched him as he answered, force of habit more than anything. Less than 10% of communication is conveyed by words. Tone of voice and body language account for the rest. He wasn't lying, but he wasn't telling me the whole truth either. "What sort of stuff?" I'd pressed.
"It's been a long day, Zeebs. Can we talk about this later?"
I'd shrugged. "It'll keep," I'd thought. "More fool me." "Why didn't he say something?" I said now, swinging onto Edgware Road. "I could have helped him."
"Maybe he thought it was too risky."
"I might talk too fast, Wolfie, but I can keep my trap shut." He laughed.
"Easy. I meant risky as in putting you at risk. Not that he couldn't trust you."
"That's bollocks. I'm ex-Special Forces. I've infiltrated Al-Qaeda cells and made nice with Russian drug lords. I think I can handle myself on Civvy Street, even if I'm not allowed to carry a P226 anymore."
"Doesn't mean he'd have wanted to put you in harm's way."
His voice dropped a notch. I understood the tone change. He wasn't just empathizing with Duncan. He was projecting. I decelerated as the lights by Lord's Cricket Ground changed from amber to red. "I think there's another reason why he hid the flash drive behind that socket," I said. "He could have tucked it away at the bottom of a drawer or in his desk. Anywhere. I never went through his things. I respected his privacy. He knew that."
"Right.
He can't have been hiding it from me. He wouldn't have needed to." I paused.
Once I said it, it'd be out there.
So he must have been hiding it from someone who wouldn't like what he was doing, someone who'd know how to stop him.
A pro. Just like the person who shot him.
Chapter 8. Duncan's homicide was clean, economical. A single shot to the head. No overkill, no lengthy bleed out. The killer hadn't wanted him to suffer. He'd simply wanted to eradicate him. A professional hit, then. A highly trained sniper, someone who knew exactly what he was doing. The bullet was fired from a van with no signage and no plates. An L85A2 assault rifle was found tossed two streets away. No prints. Serial number filed off. And the shooter was obviously ex-military, given his MO and choice of weapon. The L85 is part of the SA-80 family of firearms. It's been the British Armed Forces' standard-issue service rifle since the late 1980s. This was someone with a serious skill set who'd charge a fair whack for his expertise. That much I'd known for a while, and up till now the questions had always been, who'd paid his bill, and why had they targeted my husband? Only now might we be closing in on answers. To the second question, at any rate. The first was still a mystery.
"You always said someone put a hit on Duncan," Jack said, picking up the thread.
"And now we may have stumbled on the reason."
"You're talking about what was on the flash drive?"
"Aye. I nodded. The other thing we always said was his death was linked to something he was working on, despite what that lazy ass Calder seems to think. Bodie Calder was the DI heading up Duncan's homicide investigation. A real chair-born ranger, the sort of bloke who didn't like to get his hands dirty or colour outside the lines.
And given the date the file on the stick was last saved, it looks like we were right,
Jack said, finishing my sentence for me. Duncan was working on something top secret. A personal investigation, off the books. Someone got wind of it, they felt threatened, and they did what they needed to do to shut him up. Breaking it down to parade rest like that clarified things.
But Calder must have checked that angle, Jack said. He'll have worked out the homicide was related to something Dunk was working on, even if he doesn't know what it was.
Not according to the none too regular updates I've been getting from him. It's almost like he doesn't want to go down that particular dirt track. Every time I try to push him on it, he seems to go a different course. He'll have to listen now, though, won't he?
I don't know, Mac. I'm not sure you should say anything. Not yet, anyhow.
What do you mean? I said, breaking suddenly as a fox darted out in front of me. An inch closer, and it would have been roadkill.
It's just a hunch, but if this file of Duncan's is what got him murdered, you marching into HQ, waving it about, could very well get you done in too.
I was about to tell him I could take care of myself, my go-to response, but then I stopped. It's not that I don't think I can defend myself. Far from it. Train hard, fight easy is an unofficial Special Forces motto. I give my punch bag a good beating on a regular basis, and unless a case gets in the way, I run 6.5 miles every day, 8 on weekends, though I always vary my route and times. We learned early on in basic training that the best habit is not to have habits. Predictability gets you killed. But maybe Jack had a point. Maybe now wasn't the time to go blabbing about what I'd found. Perhaps it'd be better to find out what Duncan was investigating first. A name will get me a hell of a lot further than a theory, I thought. A Smith & Wesson beats 4 aces, our instructor used to say. The guy was full of gems when he wasn't cussing us out. I pulled up as close as I could get to the crime scene and cut the engine. Fine, you win, Wolfie. I'll hold my fire, but at some point, the safety catch is going to have to come off. Chapter 9. Primrose Hill, London, 0434. Name, said the PC on the crime scene gate, the first attending officer. Zeba McKenzie, offender profiler. I'm part of the Scotland Yard MIT. DCI Falcon sent me. I handed over my ID. He flicked his eyes from the badge to my face, then made a note on his clipboard. PPE's over there. He pointed out a box of protective clothing outside the big white tent, set up to preserve the scene and shield the body. MHGCO. My house gets cold often. Mask, hat, gloves, coveralls, overshoes. There's an order for what goes on before you can examine a body. I don't need the mnemonic anymore, but I still find myself saying it every time I kit up. Once I was in my suit, I changed gloves and helped myself to another 2 pairs from the Microflex box, my fingers moving stiffly in the double layer of latex. Ready when you are. The copper looked at his watch, added another note to the log, and raised the cordon. Inside, the tent was lit up film set style for the CSIs processing the scene, placing markers by exhibits according to what was likely to degrade fastest.
There's another passive stain over here.
A forensic photographer fired off some shots, while a CSI shone a torch along the ground to highlight the blood drops, then made a contemporaneous note for his report. These days, crime scene investigators don't just have to worry about chain of custody. They also have to be sticklers for getting the documentation right. No one wants evidence thrown out in court because the paperwork's off. A knot of detectives hovered near the corpse. It was easy to spot the DI among them. His power stance, legs wide, arms behind the back, was a clear indication of his status. DI Isaacson, I'm Zeba McKenzie. He squinted, a sign of distrust.
Good to meet you. The DCI said you were coming.
There were dark circles under his eyes, and his skin was pale, tinged with grey. The guy looked like he hadn't had a decent kip in weeks, but given Scotland Yard had only just taken on the case, whatever was keeping him awake had its roots closer to home.
Falkland speaks highly of you,
he said, his voice clipped. The praise was reluctant, the tone out of sync with his words. He doesn't want me on board, I thought, adjusting my hat to better cover my hair. Had Falcon needed to apply pressure? I'm even less good with politics than I am with people. Diplomacy was never part of the SF training program. So although I read the situation, I can't say I handled it well. The perp struck twice now. Given the narrow window between kills, the likelihood is he'll attack his next victim soon. That means you won't only have public panic to deal with, you're also going to have the media riding your ass, not to mention the commissioner. I know the way serial killers operate. They may have different MOs and signatures, but they all have one crucial thing in common. They're driven by the need to dominate, compelled to act out the same crime over and over again in a progression of increasingly violent acts. You may not like having me around, but you need me because I'm the one person who can tell you what this guy's thinking and what he's going to do next. Isakson clenched his jaw. It wasn't a good sign.
I'm well aware of the benefits of offender profiling, and I appreciate you coming down here at this time in the morning. Perhaps you'd like to give me your take on the crime scene.
Nice one, Zeba, I thought. Way to make friends. But at least he wasn't anti-profiling per se. That would be one battle less to fight.
Do you mind, Mouse?
Isakson said to the pathologist as he approached the body. Mouse? It took me a moment. The name on his badge. Mick. So these guys were pals. Good to know the DI wasn't as hard as a woodpecker's lips with everyone. I started when I saw the victim. She looked so much like me, even more than Yasmin Pejman. I knelt down, careful not to touch the corpse and risk disturbing anything, sensitive to the CSI's twitching behind me. She'd been posed on her back, skirt pulled up, legs spread wide. It was degrading. Whatever the killer had felt, it wasn't remorse. I looked closer. Normally, it's the smell of a cadaver that gets me feeling crunchy. This time, it was the sight. Flesh gashed, womb hacked out, body turned to pulp. The crime was about domination. The killer's goal was less about murder and more about exercising total power over another human being. And going by her resemblance to the first victim, he had a definite type. One eye fitted. The offender's need to control stems from the fact he has little or no control over his own life, I said, turning to Isakson. Likely he feels emasculated by a female figure, and he's lashing out at surrogates because he can't take his anger out on her. The stabbing suggests impotence. It's often a substitute for the act of penetration. An impotent offender motivated by power and control will often use a knife on a victim because, for him, sex is about domination rather than physical pleasure. He hates what he can't have and wants to destroy it. While the level of overkill suggests the offender is in a psychotic break.
So, mentally ill?
Very possibly. Certainly he has issues.
Anything else?
The absence of ligature marks shows the victim wasn't restrained or abducted by force, so the killer must have found a way to control her. Probably a ruse. That suggests a reasonable IQ and social skills. He appears unthreatening to his victims. He doesn't stand out. His targets may even have known him. Isakson nodded, a perfunctory movement that resembled a tick. His arms were now folded across his chest, creating a barrier. His expression was impassive. Not the sort of bloke to liven up a party, I thought. He reminded me a bit of myself in that respect. Though not half as much as the victim lying at my feet with her womb ripped out.
Chapter 10. My husband's always saying I'd be lost without him. And he's right. No one gets me the way he does. His parents were just like mine. I mean, he didn't have anyone like GC to deal with. But his folks were every bit as cold and hard to please. With him, it was more his dad than his mom. But he still knows what rejection tastes like. He knows how it dulls the color of everything. But it's all changing now. Spinning away from me. Out of control. I'm Alice, falling through the rabbit hole. Down, down, down. Not knowing if the falling will ever end. It still feels like a betrayal to close my eyes. And I'm walking around in a daze half the time. Propped up with Diet Coke and whatever other stuff I can get my hands on. I haven't slept properly for months. Not since he found us. God, how could I have let it happen? How can I have been so stupid and weak? No wonder he hates me so much. Even so, it scares me, his loathing. And it's gotten worse. The moment I hear his key in the lock, it's like the air becomes thick, so I can hardly breathe, and my heart starts to pound till the thundering in my ears is all I can hear. He's been making me keep the door open when I use the bathroom and chucking my stuff away for a while. But this is different. If only I could remember what I did to provoke him this time. But all I've got is a big black hole where the memories should be. And that's even more frightening than what he might do next.
Chapter 11. Primrose Hill, London, 0515. I'd just left the crime scene when I sensed it. A movement in my side vision. I stopped walking and looked around. Who's there? Hands raised instinctively to my face, I scanned the vicinity, turning my head slowly, my gaze sweeping the area. Nothing to my left or right, no one behind me or up ahead. The place was deserted. And yet I couldn't shake the feeling I wasn't alone. I stood still, listening. There was plenty of noise coming from the tent. Voices, footsteps, the click of cameras and the sound of evidence markers being placed on the ground. But the movement I'd picked up on hadn't come from the tent. It had been near where I was now. My heart beat loudly as I strained to listen. My hair billowed in the wind. Even the sound of my breathing was amplified. There was nothing else. And yet... The sun wasn't up. It was brightly lit inside the tent, though out here the night was black, the darkness a perfect cover. Was the killer hiding, observing the forensic team from some secret position? Observing me? Or maybe it was a witness, shaken up and rooted to the spot? I felt the change in the air before I saw it, a cat springing out of the shadows, a scraggy thing with ribs poking through its fur. You numpty, I thought. Ticker in my gullet. That's what happens when you go without your Zeds. You start seeing things. I wasn't due at the yard until 9. I should get some shut-eye before the team briefing, I thought, sliding into my car. I yawned widely and started the engine. I'd been looking forward to a quiet morning before I found the flash drive yesterday and got the call from Falcon. Reading the papers in bed. A walk by the river, maybe. Eggs and bottomless coffee at the cafe I like down the road. I should have known better than to plan for an easy day, I thought, pulling onto Regent's Park Road. There was a woman wearing a duffel coat zigzagging along the pavement, head bent, arms clutching her chest. Tired and emotional, my mother would have said. Always one for euphemisms. Further up, some bloke was walking an elderly German shepherd with dodgy hips, and a Bimmer 3 series was coming out of a side road. But otherwise, the streets were quiet, just the way I like them. I popped in a Davud Azad CD and zoned out to the traditional Persian music of my childhood. It wasn't until I turned onto Prince Albert Road that I realized I'd been looking at things all wrong. I'd been worried getting involved in the murder investigation would force the business with the flash drive to take a back seat. But maybe it didn't have to. I didn't have the foggiest what Duncan's notes meant, but they clearly had something to do with a Scotland Yard operation codenamed Sunlight, which suggested at least some of the people he'd referred to worked at HQ. Being based there could have its uses. I stopped at the lights on Maida Vale. A black cat washing itself on a wall glanced up, then carried on with its ablutions. And that's when it hit me. The cat that had scared me half to death at the crime scene. When it had run out of the shadows, its ears had been pricked. But it hadn't been looking at me. It had been looking in the opposite direction. Chapter 12. Bloomfield Villas, London, 0820. I'd just turned out of my road on my way to the yard, feeling refreshed after a short nap and a shower, when my mobile rang. Jack.
"Thought I'd give you a quick buzz before I head in," he said. "There's a story my editor wants me to check out. Might not get much chance to speak later."
"What story's that?" I said, swinging on to Warwick Avenue.
"This guy, Dale Redwood, chucked himself off London Bridge a few days ago. Talk about a crap end to a crap life. He spent his childhood in care. Dad died of cancer when he was 4. Mum got knocked down on Oxford Street when he was 9. He spent his early 20s being treated for personality disorders and what have you. And then this.
Some people have all the luck."
"I know, right? But here's the interesting bit. The police found a suicide note at his bedside. At the end of it, he wrote, 'Those bastards are to blame for what happened to me, but no one can touch them, and they know it.'"
"What bastards? And what made him think they were above the law?"
"Dunno. Told you it was interesting."
"Aye, definitely."
"So, you had any more ideas about the flash drive?"
he said, the real reason for his call. I thought back to what Duncan had written. Just a few lines, shorthand for whatever he was looking into, but important enough to conceal behind a phony plug socket.
"Op Sunlight. Why no arrests? Why was inquiry scrapped? What kiss? What happened to DA? Gavin Handler, 9 months undercover.
Where's the evidence?
Craig Bowden, MP. Others?"
Operation Sunlight must have been a vice job, given where Dunk was working when he was shot. They've renamed it, you know. SCD-9.
Geez, the Met loves its abbreviations, doesn't it? Way of keeping the barriers up, if you ask me.
Probably. They're certainly not over fond of outsiders.
Well, you get on all right with Falcon, and he's the only one that matters.
It was a conversation we'd had plenty of times before. Duncan was a big enough cheese over at the yard for most people to treat his memory with respect and behave themselves round me. But there are always one or two that make it clear when I pitch up that they'd rather be working with someone who's graduated from Hendon, the police training college over in North London. "From what Duncan wrote, it sounds like Sunlight involved an undercover sting," I said, accelerating hard to get through the lights before they turned red again.
"Gavin Handler, 9 months undercover," said Jack, quoting the file.
"Right, that's a big-time commitment from the head shed's perspective. The senior investigating officer would never have got the go-ahead without good cause. So why was the op scrapped?"
"Lack of results."
"That'd explain why there were no arrests, but what about the evidence? Sounds like it went missing, which is hinky to say the least."
"Agreed. I tried looking into some of the people he talked about. There are some Gavin Handlers on LinkedIn. One of them's a DC at the yard, transferred from Bristol. Could be our guy."
I found him too. Worth looking into. The others are in the wind, though. There are 50 Craig Bowdens out there. Without a way to whittle the list down, it's impossible to know which, if any, is the one from the file. Watkiss is a ghost without a first name, and MP and DA could be anyone." Jack clucked his tongue on the roof of his mouth. It made a knocking sound down the line.
"I'd better get moving. We've got an editorial review meeting first thing. Oh, joy."
I laughed. "Have fun. I'll catch you later.
How about I come round after the paper gets put to bed? We can put our heads together then. I'll pick up Chinese. There's nothing in this world that can't get resolved over spring rolls and crispy seaweed.
Great, I said, hoping he wouldn't hear the hesitation in my voice. There had been an awkward moment in his car, not so long ago, an almost kiss. Neither of us had spoken about it since, but the feelings it had roused hadn't gone away, and the more I tried to talk myself out of them, the more resolutely they'd stuck. It's only natural I'd feel attracted to him, I'd told myself. It'd be weird if I didn't. We spend so much time together, and he's certainly easy on the eye. But this wasn't just about simple desire, and I knew it. For a while I tried avoiding him, taking my time to answer his messages, not taking his calls, being unavailable when he suggested meeting up. I'm sure he was hurt and confused by how standoffish I'd been, but I had no choice. To get my heart back in line, I needed distance. The SF selection course is famous for its ball-busting tasks. A series of timed 24 to 64 kilometre marches over the Brecon Beacons mountain range in South Wales, carrying increasingly heavy backpacks. A 500-metre swim in full combat gear. And a jungle training phase in Brunei. All combined with extreme sleep deprivation. Most candidates don't make it through the first 24 hours. And yet none of what I experienced back then came close to how difficult I was finding it to temper my feelings now. Duncan's best mate was off limits. Being with him would be a betrayal. I shouldn't even be thinking about it. And now he was suggesting a late-night rendezvous at my basher. Just what I didn't need. Chapter 13. Scotland Yard, 08:45. I managed to find a parking spot just off St. Ermin's Hill and hurried over to the yard for the morning briefing. NSY is on the junction of the Broadway and Dacre Street, a nondescript glass-fronted office block set behind concrete barriers, a recent countermeasure against car bombing. Everywhere I looked, people were wearing paper poppies in the run-up to Remembrance Sunday. I was the only one without a flower on my jacket. I make regular donations to the British Legion and Help for Heroes, but for the last 2 years I haven't been able to bring myself to wear a badge. I had one on my lapel the night Duncan was shot. When I got home from the hospital, it was stained with his blood. For me, poppies aren't just symbols of war and sacrifice. They're also an unbearable reminder of my husband's murder and what came after. I swallowed hard, the old tightness back in my throat. The poppies were only part of it. I always feel a stab in the gut coming here. It's where I met Duncan and where we fell in love. I'll always associate it first and foremost with him.
SRR, he said when we were introduced. Our most deniable army intelligence unit. I'd love to know what you guys really do.
I grinned. I'm not sure you would.
Suck it up, Mackenzie, I thought now, walking past the armed officers from the Diplomatic Protection Group patrolling the exterior of the building.
Morning. I flashed my profiler ID at the PC outside the visitor's entrance before walking through the sliding doors.
Hello there, Mac. How are you keeping? Said Paddy, a DS from Duncan's day, as I made my way through the airport-style security.
I detected a whiff of flowery soap, geranium with a hint of bergamot, a distinctly feminine smell.
New lady in your life?
I said, thinking it must be serious if he was showering at her place on a school day.
Say, how'd you know that?
I smiled.
You look happy.
Well, it's true.
I am.
So what brings you here? You on this Primrose Hill case? I heard we've taken over from Kentish Town.
Killers turned serial, for feck's sake.
It wasn't even 9 o'clock. Word travels fast round here. Unless...
You're not working at 2, are you?
I said, hoping.
Nah, I've moved off Homicide. I hear Isaacson's running the show. Good luck with that, hey?
Why, what's wrong with him?
Let's just say they don't call him Mr. Cheerful on account of his sunny disposition. And by all accounts, he's not overly fond of working with folk who haven't passed through Hendon, if you get my meaning.
Not another one. My mother's an English Protestant. My father was an Iranian Jew. At school, I was always the new girl, and in the special forces, I was regularly outnumbered by male oppos. I'm used to being outside the circle. I may not enjoy working with Donald Isaacson, but I had no doubt I could handle him.
I'd best be heading off, said Paddy, checking his watch. Nice seeing you, Mac.
Damn! I should have asked him if he knew Gavin Handler, I thought, registering at the front desk. He did a stint in Vice a few years back. Maybe he'd even heard something about Sunlight. Though probably not, given the secrecy surrounding it.
Someone here knew about it, though. I just had to find out who and what.
Chapter 14. Briefing Room, Scotland Yard, 0900.
Morning, people,
said D.I. Isaacson, his expression deadpan. He was chewing cinnamon gum. Nicorette. Giving up fags isn't going to make him any friendlier, I thought, glancing round the room. Interactive whiteboard, old projector in the corner, and semicircled around the DI, a fortress of blokes. 12 in all, gym arms folded, faces set. There was only one other female. A freckle-faced blonde, soft features, no makeup. I was seated at the end of the horseshoe, part of the team but still an outsider. Always the way, first day on the job.
I think most of you know each other, although you may not be acquainted with Zeba McKenzie here,
said Isaacson, pointing me out to the group.
She's an offender profiler, works with us on a freelance basis, and specialises in serial killers. Her most recent stint with us was on the London Lacerator.
There was a murmur of interest. The Lacerator had been a major case, and for me, a personal one too.
McKenzie, do you want to give us a 2-second overview of what you bring to the party for those of us who haven't worked with a profiler before?
Sure. I'll be developing a psychological portrait of the killer to help focus the search and predict his future actions. I'll also advise on media strategy and put out appeals for information. Someone out there knows more than they realise. My task is to draw that person out. Another quick nod from Isaacson.
Any questions? No? Okay, let's move on. The sooner everyone gets up to speed, the sooner we can get on with our jobs.
There was a definite emphasis on the word our. It was subtle, but a dig all the same. A laying down of the them and us line. Me on one side, the rest of the team on the other.
The latest Vic is Lily Abian, 27 years old, unmarried, and a lawyer working at the same firm and department as our first victim, Yasmin Pejman.
With a Farsi surname, like Pejman too, I thought. Was the killer Iranian? Statistically, offenders pick targets from the same ethnic group as themselves. Or perhaps the woman the victims represented to the killer was from that part of the world.
There are no obvious defensive wounds on Abian's body,
the DI said in his clipped voice.
Same as the first Vic.
So, neither of them tried to fight off the killer. That suggested a surprise attack, or that they knew the killer, further backed up by the absence of defensive wounds.
Looks like COD's exsanguination, though there was possible asphyxiation too.
Isaacson continued. I raised an eyebrow. It was an unusual combination.
And in both cases, the offender cut out the victim's womb.
He brought an image of Yasmin Pejman's butchered corpse up on the screen.